So continuing a bit with fullness and interdependence. For those of you who have been here in recent weeks, and maybe those who've been hanging out with me for some time, you know that I have been wrestling with, at least for a couple of weeks, and maybe for several years, with the way that some popular interpretations of Mahayana Buddhist doctrine support a sense of being in the world that has an orientation that is appreciative, full, vibrant, engaged, and that in a way really supports beautifully the intention and inspiration that many of us have to engage in the world in a way that's conducive to well-being in the here and now. Engage in an activist way, engage in a relational way. And one of the things that nags at me about the non-dual doctrines, like radical interdependence and other ways of looking at experience as being full in a way that is that emphasizes the vibrancy in things rather than emphasizing the impermanence or the suffering in things, is that I'm really curious about how those ideas mesh with and hopefully support the attitude toward liberation that I find in the early texts. So I think I'm hesitating a lot here because I really don't want to come across as like denigrating some of these ideas, but I do want to investigate them in a way that's helpful. Part of what we looked at last week and the week before was the ways that early Mahayana non-dual or monistic, everything is all one, ideas were taken up by modernism and mixed with ideas coming from German Romanticism and from American Transcendentalism to give rise to what we could call like 20th century New Age Buddhist idealism. So the ancient image of Indra's net, where the universe is composed of an infinite geometric array of shimmering reflective points, each point reflecting all the other points, as a metaphor for how one can William Blake-ify one's perception, seeing the world in a grain of sand, seeing the universe in a grain of sand. That this idea of Indra's net can be supportive for that part of ourself that needs a way out of the crushing, sometimes, perception that the world is broken or fragmented or filled with evil, or that we as individuals and others we see as individuals are alone, isolated, lost, separate individuals. And one of the ways this doctrine came into the modern period was through these influences from the 19th century, where the German Romantics were already responding to the Industrial Revolution and the fallout from the Rational Enlightenment, and coming up with the sense that something was being lost in the new urban culture, and that there was something that could be found when a person, usually a solitary, noble male individual, went out into the wilderness and found themselves again, and found themselves in the presence of a kind of divine nature purity. And so this idea, this romantic idea, is interwoven with Christian ideas about the soul and the individual, and ideas about nature as the Garden of Eden, and as a reflection of divine perfection that we could come into contact with if we step away from the sinful, painful works of man. I'll leave that in the gendered man, the works of man, the cities with their factories belching smoke, and the wars that were slowly assembling as the colonial period gathered force. So the romantic impulse fits very well with this ancient idea that everything is one radiant fullness. In colonial North America, this came through the work of the Transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau, and later John Muir, with similar ideas around how contact with nature can purify the senses, purify the soul. And then in the 20th century, unfolded in a way that had the individualist and almost libertarian approach coming from the Romantics mixed with this ancient unifying transcendent theory. The Buddhist idea of interdependence in the early Mahayana really points to the perception of difference as fundamentally being an illusion. So we can think of these as practices. We talked a couple weeks ago about the deep, unitive, meditative states that likely gave rise to these visions in the first place. And there are some meditative states that naturally give rise to visions that are geometric. And you might think of, you might think of Alex Gray's paintings, if you know this visionary psychedelic artist of the late 20th century, where there's like a grid field radiating out from energy centers. And this is a common image, the kind of grid that shows up in visionary literature and visionary imagery for a long time. It seems from contemporary experience and reports to be a place that the inner eye goes sometimes when vision opens up, is this kind of geometric, woven kind of sense. And so Indra's net may well have come from a deep kind of psychedelic meditative vision like that. And so it makes sense in a way that a 20th century modern Buddhist, or Buddhist-inspired, or Buddhist-adjacent literature would arise carrying some of these extraordinary images. Also remember that by the mid-20th century, the psychedelics are beginning to arrive, and early Buddhist and Buddhist-inspired folks are also psychedelic-inspired. So Aldous Huxley starts to do his work, and in the 50s, LSD appears, and those states begin to inform contemporary Buddhism. My entire lineage could, in some ways, can be thought of as descended from the hippies who went to South Asia, partly looking for a more reliable access to the visionary experiences they were finding on LSD. And of course, folks like Ram Dass and you know, Timothy Leary are very much ancestors in this lineage in the West. So there's an interweaving of this ancient visionary practice with contemporary visionary practice, and then an ancient monistic or unity-oriented philosophy with a contemporary philosophy that, riding on Romanticism and Transcendentalism, is really looking for a way to talk about our existence in a way that's more unifying. We're starting to feel the results of individualism and the painfulness of really the playing out of industrial life, folks having left the countryside, come to urban centers, families beginning to fragment, communities beginning to fragment, isolation beginning to grow. And so the doctrines of unity and oneness and acceptance start to be useful in this modern and then now postmodern environment. And so we have these non-dual approaches to life, seeing everything is connected, that are tremendously helpful as a response to particular kinds of suffering, particularly the sufferings of separation and isolation, etc. How do they meet the insight-based and concentration-based discernment practice that we find in the early texts? Because the Buddha never talked about union, and he never talked about everything being all one. He rarely said that everything was anything. That wasn't really his thing. At the closest we get to that is, you know, is statements that come through like the teaching of the characteristics. You know, like all phenomena are selfless. But also, much of the time, he didn't actually say all phenomena. He would say, you know, form is selfless, feeling is selfless. He would use the framework of the five khandhas, the aggregates or the aspects. You know, sabbe sankhara anatta, often this is translated as all phenomena are not self or selfless. But sankhara, sabbe sankhara dukkha, sabbe sankhara anatta, sankhara doesn't actually mean phenomena. Sankhara is a term that is almost universally used as a negative, as a pejorative in the early texts. And it's really mental formations or volitional formations. So it's not all phenomena are selfless. It's volitional formations are selfless. So the willful narrative impulses that we move through in the world, those are selfless. That's a much more specific instruction than the kind of big instruction, you know, all phenomena are selfless. The Buddha didn't talk about all phenomena much. He was much more interested in the pragmatic specificity of particular phenomena. So what are the phenomena that it's helpful to see as selfless? Well, particularly my own stories, you know, my own drama, my own narratives, and these are volitional formations, so my own desires, the things I want, and the way that my wanting unfolds as action. And it's much more ethical than existential. Existential is philosophies that say, what is reality? What is existence? And ethics is philosophy that says, how should I act? What should I do? And these are different branches of philosophy. The Buddha's teachings are far more ethical than they are existential. But in the Mahayana, one of the things that would happen is, with the rise of this visionary experience, the ethical would start to recede in importance, and the existential would come forward. Because if you're really writing about experiences of everything shimmering with a vibratory energy, that washes out distinction, right? It's more of a what we would call a unitive state, or it feels like a unitive state. It's one thing. The deep concentration states are all kind of one thing. But we don't move in the world from a posture of one thingness. You know, we don't see everyone the same. even though we practice in loving kindness, extending kindness to everyone. That's an ethical act. We don't translate that into saying everyone is functionally the same, right? Nothing in the text says we should do that. It says quite the opposite, in fact, that beings should be encountered in a way that is skillful and responds to difference. So how are people different from each other, right? To one monk who was, you know, deeply analytical and you know, kind of intellectually brilliant, the Buddha would give a very complex teaching on breaking down the constituents of experience into long lists of detailed separate parts and investigating all these different things. To another monk who wasn't having much progress in practice, and was about to disrobe, actually, to leave the community because he couldn't get anywhere in his meditation. Lots of us may have been in moments like this. That's it. It's called the rolling up the mat phase. He was about to roll up the mat and go home. And it was made worse by the fact that his older brother was skilled in meditation. So his older brother had already, gotten much further in practice and was teasing his younger brother and kind of bullying him a bit. So he had gotten far in his meditation, but he wasn't very nice yet. So, you know, still had some work to do, older brothers. But the younger brother was about to quit, and the Buddha goes to him and says, he says, I can't do this, you know. And the Buddha says, take this white cloth. Gives him a white cloth. I don't know where he got it. Just produced it out of thin air. Gave him his handkerchief. I don't know. Gives him a white cloth and says, just rub this. So he's rubbing the cloth. And of course, you know, his hands are a little dirty and sweaty, whatever. He's rubbing it and rubbing it, rubbing it. And pretty soon the cloth is dirty, but his hands are a little cleaner. And the Buddha says, what do you see? And he's like, dirt. And the Buddha's like, that's it, man. That's all it is. It's a purification practice. You just got to rub the mind. Just rub it, you know. Just keep at the friction. And that was the instruction that this kid got, and it worked. He was able to somehow that was just the right simile. It's like this. You know, do this, that he was able to find concentration. He shortly actually not only attained some levels of liberation, attained stream entry and more, but he got psychic powers. His concentration became so strong that he got psychic powers, and he used to play supernatural tricks on his older brother. Aha, take that, you know. So the Buddha was famous for what's called skill and means, upaya kaushalya in Sanskrit. That term would become really central in the Buddha, in the Bodhisattva doctrine somewhat later on, that Buddhas have this ability to speak to anyone, wherever they are in their practice, and to give the right teaching for them. So these teachings are really different. It's not a unitive teaching. The Buddha doesn't just go around to everyone and say, hey, everyone, you know, accept everything without distinction. That's not the teaching. And so when we work with existential or non-dual teachings that say it's possible to perceive everything as being, you know, radically interwoven, completely what it is, not needing to be otherwise, what we are saying, in a way, is that there's a liberation pathway that bypasses discernment, and hopefully skillfully, right? And I think this is partly dependent on, this, at least classically, this was partly dependent on access to those states. Because if you can actually get your mind into a state that is, you know, radically spacious, like what's called the arupa jhanas, the formless states, infinite consciousness, infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, neither perception nor non-perception. These are unitive states of consciousness that are deeply stable, deeply still, and have no distinction in them. They consist of one perception that fills the entirety of one's awareness. With some skill in those states, I think what the non-dual teachings point us toward is something like resting in that sense of everything being one shimmering vastness. Learn from that in such a way that the constrictions of your own narrative, your own heart, your own preferences are blown away. Maybe a way of saying it is, when you contact those states, believe them. Believe them as being accurate representations of how things really are. The world really is radically awake. Everything is conscious. Everything is marked by spaciousness. Actually, there's nothing here at all in terms of distinct things. What the Mahayana does, in part, is it understands those states as touching into something that's true. And if we could really get that, if we really get that that's true, what would happen to our defilements? Right? They would be, in a certain way, washed away. Not by resolving them individually, not like by working with my anger and coming to forgiveness and acceptance, but actually just by, you know, understanding that my anger is like one tiny hot coal in an infinite ocean of cool water. It just gets snuffed. Like the ocean is just far too vast to be harmed or troubled by one little hot coal, right? That's the salt metaphor, right? If you put a cup of salt in a cup of water, it's undrinkable. But if you put a cup of salt in the entire river of fresh water, it's drinkable because it dissolves. Right? The ocean of being is far vaster than our defilements. And so in the early texts, we don't find teachings on the infinite as much as we find teachings on discernment and difference. So see the suffering aspect, or the dukkha, the troubledness in specific parts of our life, right? See the way, again, this, it uses the five aggregates. This is in the First Noble Truth. See the way that form inspires clinging, right? There's beautiful things, I like to look at them. There's beautiful people, I like to look at them. I want to look at them. I want to look more. I want to look more. There's beautiful art, there's beautiful trees, there's the beauty, beauty, beauty. I want to look more. Clinging arises in response to form, right? There's feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. I just want them. I want pleasant feeling. I want less an unpleasant feeling. I want more pleasant feeling. I want more pleasant feeling. I really like pleasant feeling. You know, clinging arises in response to feelings. Perceptions, right? Recognition of things. I want to know what's going on. Recognition is the labeling quality. Grasping arises, or clinging arises, in relation to perception, right? When something's happening and I don't know what it is, that's pretty intolerable for the mind. And the mind will make up completely fabricated stories to explain what's going on if perception is confused. That's one of the weird things that the brain does. And then there's, you know, again, sankhara, the fourth of the aggregates, mental formations, volitional formations. This is really where the dukkha kind of gets thick and sticky, because this is where our narratives, our desires, our stories all live. The sense of self, which is a story, lives. It's a sankhara. And so clinging arises there. And even in relation to, you know, being conscious itself, you know, if you've ever seen a toddler really struggling not to fall asleep, or a person on their deathbed really struggling not to fall asleep from this life for good. So much clinging in relation to consciousness, sense consciousness. And so we are instructed to understand this. And understanding suffering means making distinctions around experience. And so the practice of meeting the world of distinctions, the world of difference, the world of complexity fully, and not going necessarily through the pathway of washing everything out into unitive oneness, but really staying with difference still in a kind of unitive direction. I think one of the pathways to this is the Brahmavihara practice that we touched into in the meditation. And so we have the instruction in the texts to radiate the quality of metta, of loving kindness, in all directions, to all beings without exception. And then likewise with compassion, with appreciation and equanimity. So loving kindness is the foundational quality. It's the attitude of the heart that is friendly, and friendly without exception. That's more of a unitive state, right? And you can get into one of those unitive states with metta. You can enter jhana, samadhi, deep concentration, with metta as the object. And then it's just love. You enter into a field of love that fills the body, fills the space, fills the world, fills the universe. And you can, being in jhana or in those deep concentrated states with metta as the object, by definition, much of the time means that you're not focusing on specific people or specific situations. You're no longer sending metta to, your partner, your kids, the post office worker, the difficult person. It's really in the all beings form of metta, the radiating in all directions form, that the unitive states really happen. So metta by itself can be quite unitive, but then compassion and appreciation are responsive states. Compassion is metta or loving kindness responding to suffering. The entire universe is not suffering. And so compassion initially isn't a unitive state. To touch compassion, you have to notice suffering. You have to actually understand suffering, make some contact with it. And that means we're making contact with a specificity. Oh, this person is in pain. This group of people is in pain. This ecosystem is in pain. This is a theme of painfulness that runs through everything I can see. There's a kind of discernment that happens here, where in order to give rise to compassion, we temporarily separate out the painful from the pleasant, and we respond to the painful. Oh, and compassion arises. Appreciation, or mudita, sympathetic joy, appreciative joy. This is joy at the well-being of others. This is the exact flip side of compassion, why we don't teach it as much. I was going to say that I don't know, but I do know, because negativity bias says we focus on the negative much more than the positive, and so compassion. And the Mahayana folks knew that. They said, the bird has two wings, wisdom and compassion. They didn't say wisdom and appreciation. They said wisdom and compassion for a reason, which is suffering. But they're really a twin set. And appreciation is just as responsive as compassion is. To do appreciation practice, you enter the strongest foundational state of metta that you can, and then you tune your awareness to well-being. You look for well-being. And again, you have to look for specific examples, right? This friend of mine is actually doing well. I say actually because we're always surprised. Oh, look, somebody's doing well. What a treat, you know? How lovely. But of course, if you start to look, you see it everywhere. And I encourage you, especially if you have a negativity bias tendency, who doesn't nowadays? But, you know, to look for the positive, to do appreciation practice. Oh, this friend is doing well. May their well-being increase and grow and continue and increase. And this group of people is doing well, you know? We're so used to thinking that everybody's doing poorly except a few awful privileged men at the top, and they're also doing poorly, but in a different way, and we wish they would share the wealth. But, you know, there can be a perception on the left that everyone's basically suffering, either oppressed or oppressing. But it's actually helpful to look through or around or in a different way through that shimmering gem of practice and actually just see well-being. You know, people can be part of an oppressed class and still be doing quite well. People can be part of an oppressor class and be doing quite well, like in a deep way, not in a shallow way. And to look for that, right? Look for ecosystems that are doing well. And don't get all grumpy on me and say that none of them are, because, right? Even if you have to say, oh, look, the boiling storms of Venus are just as they've always been. Beautiful, stunning, lovely expressions of divine hot gases, you know? That's a goddess. Venus is a goddess. But you know, even closer to home, I think it's beautiful to, you know, our garden here is, a couple months ago, we were really like, oh my God, the gophers, they really got most of the garden. They were just like tearing it up. There's holes in everything. There was some, the sprouts were missing. We were super grumpy. And we started to do some rebuilding work, but of course we didn't get to everything. And there's any number of beds that were already planted and we were like, whatever, maybe they'll get everything. And lo, you know, 2 months later, the corn is doing great. The tomatoes are doing great. There's a bunch of lettuces that they don't seem to care for. And it's actually really helpful to go out there and be like, oh, look, all is not lost. All is not lost. And of course, it's tremendously helpful to bring into our consciousness the well-being that is happening. Our power just went out. So I think we're good for the moment. So the lights went out. But if you can hear me, that means that the internet is still on. And that's always mysterious to me because probably pretty soon the router will also turn off. But there you go. If I disappear, blessings, much love. Maybe the generator will kick on and I'll come back. I'll stay here. I won't disappear. But if I'm really gone for a while, talk amongst yourselves, discuss the positive, all that sort of thing. So I'll say what I can right here, which is that I think that the twin practice of compassion and appreciation is a way to move the energy of Indra's web, the energy of radical interdependence in a way that is responsive to the particular world. Now, maybe I'm just complaining because philosophically I don't like the New Age, but actually most of y'all are fine and don't get lost in, you know, spiritual bypassy non-dual confusion. That's great. I think most of y'all don't. Bless you. But what I think I'll encourage is that when we encounter doctrines of interdependence, fullness, unitiveness, that we understand that these doctrines are a historically specific arising that have as much to do with who we are now as who the Buddha was then. And that we notice what emotional states or attention practices they inspire in us. So like when I think about interdependence as I'm walking down the streets in Oakland, what happens? in what way does that support me there? Do I see the people that I see on the street with more particularity or less? Do I ignore people more or do I see them more? When I think about radical interdependence and I engage with the ecosystem or with the climate system, does my attention become sharper or dimmer or something else? Like what happens? And I hope that what happens, what I see, I think at its best is what happens for many folks is that attention moves away from our small stories, the individual drama, and it moves into a wider loving space, a bigger loving space. I think this is the goodness of those kinds of doctrines, if we can touch that space. And so we can feel how there's really a thread that comes through all of the Dharma teachings, whether early or later or modern or postmodern, that there's a thread that has not there's a thread that's still connected. There must be a thread that's still connected to the noble truths, I think is what I want to say, right? So don't let any teaching pull you away from the requirement to understand suffering and to uproot clinging. Our practice must be to let whatever teaching helps us see the world more clearly, do its magic, do its work, but remember liberation. I think one of the places where doubt can most so easily creep in is that the suggestion of the non-dual is that practice and purification is not necessary. And I think, and this is going to sound a little fundamentalist of me, but I think that's just Mara. I think that's Mara trying to pull folks off the path. Purification is always the path. Discernment is always the path. And Mahayana teachings of union are not in opposition to that discernment at all, but they can seem like it. And I think what they try to do at their worst, and this is again, this is not the Mahayana, this is Mara, but I think what Mara tries to do is to use non-dual teachings. This is really just a talk about spiritual bypass, I guess. Mara tries to use non-dual teachings as a way to suggest to us that practice is not necessary because everything is already perfect. Everything being already perfect is an existential teaching. That can be true, and it can still be the case that suffering is real and practice is necessary. Both of those things are perfect, but they're still necessary to understand and to engage with in a way that has discernment to it.